I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. Today, we're talking about big ideas and big change. First, we'll talk with Tim Brown, CEO of the design firm IDEO. His new book, Change by Design, shows how the techniques and strategies of design are valuable in most any endeavor. Tim will tell us how to use design thinking to approach a whole host of challenges, including those in cities. And from World War II to the moon landing, America has a long history of great achievements. And yet, it seems we have lost faith in the ability of our government to get things done. We'll talk with William Eggers and John O'Leary about their new book, If We Can Put a Man on the Moon, and what gets in the way of getting big things done in government. All that, plus the latest from Plant Edison and City View's commentator Walker Smith, coming up on today's Smart City right after this news. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Tim Brown is the CEO and president of the design firm IDEO. An industrial designer by training, Tim's own work has earned him numerous design awards, and he has a special interest in the ways in which design can be used to promote the well-being of people living in emerging economies. That interest led to his new book, Change by Design. The book introduces design thinking, the collaborative process by which the designer's sensibilities and talents are employed to match people's needs with what is technically feasible and a viable business strategy. Tim, what is design thinking?
It's a way of solving the kinds of problems that we, and challenges that we face in the world today. And it really starts with understanding the needs of human beings, what I would call human-centered design, and then uses creative tools, the tools that designers have developed really over the years, things like experimentation, prototyping, storytelling, to develop new choices, new alternatives that meet those challenges.
You use a technique called the mind map to visualize your thinking. In fact, when you open Change by Design, you find a mind map right there in the frontispiece. Describe the technique and why you use it.
I think that we're used to using kind of linear forms of exploring ideas using words and verbal stories. And what I find when I'm trying to think through something, particularly something where there are lots of connected pieces, where there's not an obvious linear path, that using a mind map, which is really where I take each idea and put it down on the page and then figure out how it might connect to other ideas and literally join them together until I have this visual map of all of the things that I'm thinking about and how one thing relates to another, it helps me think about the complexity of the idea in a more thorough way. It helps me understand the relationships between different things, so that in the case of the book, the reason I used the mind map first was just to explore the right relationships between the different things that I wanted to talk about, so that then when I did put it into a narrative form, hopefully it made some sense.
Do you think that mind maps feel right to you or feel comfortable to you because you're a designer and you think visually versus, let's say, a writer who may think in a very linear fashion? In other words, is that technique particularly suited to someone with artist sensibilities and an artist way of thinking?
I think it's like any other tool. You get more comfortable with it as you use it more. And I wasn't particularly comfortable with mind maps when I first started to use them, and I've got better at them over the years as I've used them more. And the same as I don't consider myself to be, for instance, a naturally great draftsman or great at drawing. I've taught myself to draw better and better over the years. I think it's a tool that, to be honest, anybody could learn to use. And like all tools, the more you use them, the better you get at them.
Of course, design thinking is now, all the rage, and business schools are introducing design thinking. The Masters of Design is the new MBA and so forth and so on. So the whole notion of design in business and in government and problem solving generally and in innovation has been elevated in a big way over the last few years. And I'm wondering, is it a talent that one develops? Is it a process or a disciplined way of approaching a problem or an opportunity? I mean, characterize it for me.
Well, I think it's made up of two things, really. That it's made up of a set of methodologies, which are processes, if you like, which indeed everybody can learn, anybody can learn, and like any other tools, can get better and better at using over time. It's also made up of a set of sensibilities, and those sensibilities, things like confidence in using one's intuition, the ability to be kind of to really listen and look and be empathic. Some of these things are naturally found in some people to a great degree and less in others. But in my opinion, we can all build those sensibilities over time with effort and practice. But they're not methods. They're ways of being, if you like. And I think great design thinking uses both. It uses the right processes and it uses the right sensibilities.
You write that design is fundamentally an exploratory process. As a designer, how do you know when to keep exploring design options and when to draw conclusions and bring the exploration phase to a close?
To be really honest with you, I don't. In other words, I think if I was given the choice, I would keep designing forever. And I think most designers are like that. I mean, obviously, we can continue to explore and diverge, which is why deadlines are so important. It's why projects are structured the way they are. It's why constraints are so important, because constraints help kind of provide a space in which to design. But to be honest, if I didn't have deadlines, I would probably never stop designing.
Talk a little bit more about constraints. In fact, you quote one great designer as saying, "The mark of a designer is a willing embrace of constraints." And I think that runs counter to what most people think of designers. Explain what you meant by that and why you agree.
You're right. We are tempted to think that the best design happens on a blank sheet of paper, that it happens when we have no constraints, and so somehow new ideas emerge from that. But the reality is that the sort of immensity of that open space, that blank space, is more than most people can use. And I think what constraints do is they give you something to push against. So whether it's the constraint that something has to be inexpensive, or whether it's the constraint that something has to be really simple to use, or whatever it might be, those constraints give you some edges to design around. And there's always lots and lots of space. And the trick is, when you're setting a design brief, when one's thinking about the question to answer, is not to make the constraints too narrow, because if they're too narrow, then there is no creative space, but nor to make them too big. There's a sweet spot. And, you know, I found working over the years with great designers and great companies that so much of ultimate success of a design project is based on getting that set of constraints right at the beginning.
Let me ask you this, speaking of constraints. How do you use customer research in the design process?
What I'm looking for when I do consumer research, and what we all look for as designers, is we're not looking for the answers. We're not looking to go out and sit down in a focus group and ask people what they want. What we're looking for are insights about people's behavior, things that they do or don't do that offer up an opportunity, that perhaps illustrate a need that they might have. So, for instance, when we were interested in understanding how people save money or don't save money, we were doing some work with the Bank of America. We went out and met with people and followed people around, and we saw two behaviors which were interesting. One was that some people were rounding up their utility bills. They were, whatever the amount was that the utility company was asking for, they would round it up to the nearest $10, whatever it was. And when we asked them why they did that, they said, well, it's because I'd never want to get behind. I don't want to be surprised by my next bill. So that was interesting. Another behavior that we saw is something we probably can all recognize, which is that when people paid for a cash transaction, they would take the coins that they received in change, and rather than spending them, they would take them home, stick them in a cookie tin or a jar, and every so often take those coins into the bank and pay them into their savings account, or give them to the kids to do the same thing. And those two insights just gave us this idea about, well, in a way, these people are doing automatic saving. So how could we make that easier for people? So we combine that behavior with a debit card to create this service for Bank of America called Keep the Change, where when you use a debit card to pay for a transaction, the amount is rounded up to the nearest dollar and the change is put automatically into your savings account. So we didn't go and ask people whether they wanted an automatic savings account. We didn't go and ask them whether they wanted their money to be put into a savings account when they used a debit card. We went and looked at what their behaviors were. We went and looked for the interesting things that people were doing, and then used that as a source of inspiration for our own new ideas.
Do you do your own research, or do you have it done by others and then translated to you?
No, we do our own. When it comes to this kind of what is often called ethnographic research, this going out into the world and being like an anthropologist, looking what people do, we do that ourselves. And we have everybody at IDEO is able to do it, but we also have specialists, people who come from social sciences, anthropologists, psychologists, linguists, who are the professionals at it, who help us be really good at that. But we go and do our, every team goes out and does its own research.
So Bank of America comes to you and is saying, we need a new way to be competitive. We need a new way to be competitive in our consumer market.
what do you do? How do you respond? What's your process?
We figure out what the question is that we're interested in answering. In this case, it was really trying to understand families and how they lived their lives and how they dealt with financial services. We went out and looked, and we came back with these insights, and then we explored a whole range of different ideas that came from that, not just the one that resulted in Keep the Change. There were dozens of different ideas about how we might help people better save or better manage their finances. And then, you know, ultimately out of that, you take the best ideas, and we prototype those. We make little mock-ups of them or scenarios, and we test those and try them out on people and see which ones have the most traction, which ones are most exciting and interesting. And then ultimately, you know, you evolve those and develop them like in any design process until you get something you think is right. And then that comes all the hard work of launching it.
I know that you've worked in urban settings and on urban challenges, and you just mentioned the prototyping or scenario building as part of your process. How would you prototype something that's really big and expensive, say a new transit system for cities? And what would you expect to learn from that process?
I think you can prototype in many different ways. I mean, sometimes you do it physically, and we actually have done prototypes of pieces of new transit systems physically, whether it be stations or trains, and we've done hotels and stores and things like that. But you eventually get to a scale where it's impossible to prototype it physically, and so that then we often use filmmaking and other storytelling techniques to create stories of what a system might be like and how it might operate and how it might work, and then use that to test it with different stakeholders, whether that be potential passengers or customers, or whether it be the people that have got to build the system or operate the system, or perhaps the people who are going to be working on the system delivering the service, and use that as a way of refining the idea. We often try and describe the kind of the customer journey, what journey through this system the customer might take, so that we can all better understand how to design each step as effectively as possible. And so I think you can certainly prototype things that are big and complex. In fact, we've just been recently exploring how we might tackle some of these kinds of issues around climate change, and have been creating some scenarios looking at what are the kinds of innovations that might take place over the next 20 or 30 years in all kinds of areas like food systems and clean water, but also transportation, in an effort to try and get more of a kind of a dialogue going around how design might play a role in the climate change problem. And we've just recently launched a website called livingclimatechange.com, which really invites not only we've had our own designers creating these scenarios, but invites, you know, others, designers from around the world to contribute their thoughts about how design and innovation may play a role in the climate change issue.
In terms of transportation, is there anything you can share that you think was particularly breakthrough or exciting or promising?
I think there's a long way to go before I would say we've got the right ideas. One of the scenarios, in fact, is quite a sort of dystopian one, which looks at what might happen if we continue to go along the path that we're in today of, you know, assuming that we're going to continue to commute via cars. And there's lots of potential innovation that might make that process more and more tolerable as we have to take longer and longer over it. And it's quite interesting as you follow this little scenario through and realize all of this effort that could easily go into innovation in order to support what is currently an unsustainable system. And sometimes I think design can be quite useful at illustrating what's kind of wrong with the current system as well as what might be right with a new system.
Let's talk for a minute about buzz. That's been a popular topic over the last 10 years. You write that one of your rules for good design is this: ideas that create a buzz should be favored. What do ideas that create buzz have in common?
Well, there's some kind of story, some sort of narrative, something that connects to people emotionally so that not only do they feel excited about it, but they feel excited enough about it to tell somebody else about it. And I think at a time when, in a sense, you know, conventional, you know, media, conventional ways of communicating, whether this is inside an organization, you know, you can think about the classic PowerPoint presentation, or out in the world, and we can think of advertising and conventional media, you know, we're sort of filtering so much of that stuff out. We just give it less and less attention as we're bombarded by more and more of it. which means I think some of the more interesting ideas, perhaps some of the biggest new ideas, may have to fight for attention in this more sort of biological way, as it were, of kind of being out in the world and and spreading through more kind of viral means. So, in my own organization, I'm much more interested in the ideas that are kind of percolating around the organization because people are excited about them than I am about the ideas that somebody comes and presents, through a PowerPoint presentation or in some kind of conventional way.
Interesting. I was also interested in what you had to say about a culture of optimism, that the obvious counterpart to an attitude of experimentation is a climate of optimism. You say that without optimism, the will to experiment will be frustrated until it withers. If you were in the White House today, what would you do to create in America a culture of optimism?
I think the current White House has an opportunity to do that. Perhaps we haven't seen for a decade or more with a sense of potential and optimism, which, I don't know how long that lasts within any given administration. But, I think instead of arguing about what we have to give up in order to win in terms of a kind of a policy argument, instead of doing that, if the White House, the government can help put ideas out into the world that are new and important and can help us kind of move towards solving some of these big challenges, then I think, I think that can be kind of a huge contribution. And I think there's already, evidence that's beginning to go on, perhaps. We had John Berry, who's the head of the Office of Personnel Management for the government, come by not so many months ago, came and visited us and Google and Facebook, looking at how to make working for the government cool again. And it was great to have that conversation with him, and he had lots of interesting ideas. And I think there was an article recently in Wired magazine about it. So I see evidence. I see evidence in the willingness, at least, to talk about things like climate change and energy conservation and some of these other large topics that there's a lot government can do to make us interested in exploring new potential solutions.
If you could tackle a service design, a service redesign in cities, what would you tackle?
Wow, interesting. I think there's a really interesting one. I was meeting last week with somebody out in Dubai, and we were talking about the challenge of sanitation. It's something that people don't talk about very much, and in the West, we tend to think of this it being an invisible invisible system. Our water arrives magically from some source, and then it goes away once we've used it magically and gets processed. And those systems in Western cities kind of work tolerably well, although there's an awful lot of waste involved in it. But you go to the developing world where cities can't afford to put in these big centralized systems, and ask the question: well, what should waste treatment, what should water sanitation be like in order that we can actually perhaps introduce it to all the communities we have on the planet instead of just the wealthiest ones? And what will it look like in the future such that we don't waste enormous amounts of water and send it back to the ocean in a polluted state? I think it's a service that we don't talk about, and yet it has a huge impact on our environment and could have a huge impact on the ability of the developing world to build cities that are sustainable. So that happens to be an area I'd kind of be interested in looking at.
In your book, you cite a piece of research you did on energy efficiency, and you found that people basically don't care about it. As a designer, how do you tackle that, achieving a societal goal, something that's good for society, that people really don't care about?
It happens all the time, and not just around these societal changes, but around many things. I mean, the dental industry, for instance, a long time ago realized that the way to get people interested in healthy teeth was to focus on beauty, not on health. And people responded to that much more than they did to health. And that's true of energy also. We have to, instead of focusing perhaps on the worthiness of energy conservation, we need to think about how can we integrate more energy efficiency into the things that people do care about, like decorating their homes or having a comfortable home or living an interesting life, whatever the emotional connections are that we can make between people and things they care about, and then ultimately energy conservation. That's how we'll make an impact, rather than trying to kind of browbeat everybody into being kind of worthy and somehow save energy because they think they should.
You mentioned comfort and beauty. Are there other things that are fundamental that you would typically, as a designer, thinking about a new product, a new innovation, that you would think, okay, here are some basic needs. We know people have these needs. They have these drives. If we can make this new something satisfy one of those drives, we're going to have a greater chance of success. Is there a checklist for you?
Well, I think there's a set of these things that we can, you know, that are sort of somewhat, you know, eternal, that we've always cared about as a species, if you will. One that I think is that of community, you know, that we actually want to be part of a community. We want to interact with the community. We want to communicate with people we care about. And obviously we're seeing that being the underlying force behind things like Facebook. But I think you can use it to create societal change also, that by perhaps making things like energy usage transparent at the community level, you can actually encourage people to change their behavior, partly because they don't want to look bad in the community, and partly because they want to contribute to the community. And for me, that's one, making the connection back to cities, is that cities are places that can foster communities. Now, they haven't always done that successfully in the way that perhaps we've designed them in the past. But I think if we imagine how we can use both physical design and the design of virtual communities and sort of online experiences, that we can perhaps do all kinds of interesting things with the help of this sort of notion of a community experience.
Where would you begin? If you were mayor of a mid-size American city, where would you start?
Well, you know, I think I'd certainly start by trying to understand what the community that I serve, you know, really cares about. I mean, does it care about the things that the community produces, whatever businesses or industries that it has? Does it care about the place that it is? Is it in a beautiful part of the world? Whatever. I mean, figure out what are the things that a community cares about that you can build off, that you can build perhaps new services or new behaviors from. Because I'm pretty sure somewhere in there, every community, every place has something that it identifies with. Some have many things that they identify with. And that one can use that as the starting point. I mean, I think of what has happened perhaps in New York over the last couple of decades, that somehow by refocusing New York as on the one hand, a global city that sort of represents America to the rest of the world, and on the other hand, focusing on local communities and what different parts of the city mean to the people that live there. You know, to some degree, there's a lot of transformation that's happened in New York over 20 years around crime and the cleanliness of the city and the amenities that are beginning to be offered in the city. So, you know, I recently walked the new High Line Park, for instance, which I think is just a wonderful example of, you know, of introducing a new kind of delightful community experience into an urban setting in a really wonderful way. And I think we should be looking to do not just new parks in all kinds of communities, but looking for those points that you can really make a difference.
I was on the High Line the other day, and it was very cold and very windy. And it was amazing how crowded it was. I mean, people just want to be there. And they're even lying on the lounge, you know, the wood lounge chairs.
Right. It's remarkable. It's so exciting when you see those kinds of projects succeed in that way. And obviously, there was some sort of serendipity involved in it. You know, that railway happened to be there, but it was instead of being torn down and replaced, it was used in an imaginative way. And so that, for me, you know, go back to the community and understand what its assets really are and build from those, rather than thinking everything has to be kind of taken back down to zero and started again.
Right. If organizations want to adopt a design thinking approach to problem solving and innovation, can they do it in-house, or do they need the help of outsiders?
Oh, I think it can be done in-house. I think you do need people who have got some of these natural sensibilities to help kind of spark the process. And so, you know, I would argue that anybody who's trying to lead this process needs to look hard and think hard about who they have in the organization that already exhibits these sensibilities, that already prototypes things, that's good at telling stories, that spends lots of time out in the world trying to understand what customers or consumers or ordinary people want and need. And those are the people to start with. Perhaps they're the people to build your teams around. And if you haven't got those people, then maybe it is worth thinking about, you know, going out into the world, either to hire people from bring into your organization or to work with, you know, outsiders that already know how to do it.
Tim, I love the book, Change by Design, How Design Thinking Transforms Organizations and Inspires Innovation. Thanks so much for being our guest on Smart City.
Oh, it's been wonderful. Thanks for letting me come along and have a chat.
Tim Brown is the CEO of the design firm IDEO. And now for the latest in the world of urban planning and design, we turn to Nate Berg at Plant Edison.
A long-planned $1 billion expansion of Harvard University's Science Center has been officially put on hold. The 100,000 square foot expansion has been in the works for years, but opposition in the Alston neighborhood of Cambridge, Massachusetts, coupled with a downturn in the economy, has gradually slowed down the university's plans. According to a recent article from the Boston Herald, construction work has already begun on the Science Center, and the foundation of the complex is expected to finish construction by springtime. But with plans to complete the project on hold indefinitely, the university is looking to cut at least a few of its losses by upgrading and renting out some of the vacant properties it holds in Alston. The university is reportedly seeking leases on those properties of up to 10 years, an ominous sign for the future of that expansion. Meanwhile, in the San Francisco Bay Area, conscientious carpoolers may soon see their good deeds appreciated just a little less. The Bay Area Toll Authority has been advised to begin tolling carpools crossing the area's seven bridges, according to a recent article from Toll Roads News. Carpoolers had previously enjoyed free passage over the Bay Area's bridges, but the region's toll authority is looking to increase revenue sources in the coming years as it pays for a broad program of bridge improvements. High on their list is earthquake proofing on the seven bridges, which have been hit hard by seismic activity in the past. And with the recent cracks and damages to the Bay Bridge experienced earlier this fall, generating the money to ensure the stability of the region's bridges is seen by both commuters and public officials as a high priority. And finally, in demographic news, the city of Philadelphia has for the first time in nearly 60 years grown in population. But it didn't come easy. The city's population count is actually a revised figure released by the U.S. Census Bureau after Philadelphia officials challenged the Bureau's 2007 count. Officials had suspected an undercount when the Census Bureau released its annual population estimates and issued a formal dispute of the figures. When the Census Bureau re-ran its figures, it found that the city had actually gained population in 2008. The city officially now has an additional 93,000 residents, according to the Bureau's new 2008 estimate. The increase is relatively small overall, just 1.5% compared to the population recorded in the 2000 census. But the slight increase is reason enough to celebrate for many in the city, who can now argue that Philadelphia is not dying, but in fact it's actually on its way back to life. For PlanEdison, I'm Nate Berg.
Nate Berg is the assistant editor of PlanEdison.com. Coming up after the break, authors William Eggers and John O'Leary will tell us how government can still get big things done. You're listening to Smart City. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Americans have grown dismayed by a series of high-profile failures by government. But our nation has a history of great achievements, and my guest William Eggers and John O'Leary have written If We Can Put a Man on the Moon that can help government reclaim its legacy of competence. What was it about the quest to put a man on the moon that led to success?
I think that the idea of putting a man on the moon captured the popular imagination in the nation, and it was a time when our system of government was being compared to the Soviet system. And Kennedy's challenge to put a man on the moon ignited our nation, and we all pulled together, and we were successful in doing that.
So why don't we enjoy the same sort of success on other big ideas?
Where we're in this period of time now when we're facing major, major challenges from Afghanistan to healthcare reform to energy independence and cap-and-trade legislation and the financial meltdown. So we're facing as big, if not bigger, challenges than we faced at that time. Yet the biggest challenge is probably, as you said, our ability to execute on these challenges. And the American people just don't trust government anymore to get these things right. Only 23% actually trust government to do them well. And one of the problems is that we've spent a lot of time playing the blame game, where we focus 24/7 on the political infighting between the red team and the blue team, and it confirms everyone's view that the mess in Washington is essentially the other team's fault, and it leaves no one really to tackle the hard work of improving the process by which we tackle big undertakings.
And you think it's a process problem, John?
Yeah, I think that what we found is that every big project is a journey, and it goes through a certain set of steps that are predictable. You start with an idea, you go to a legislative design, you get a public commitment, You implement it, and then you get results. And that journey from idea to result is a process. And in fact, what we found was that there were traps all along that journey, all throughout that process, that worked against success. In fact, when we put a man on the moon, we had to have everything go right. And in fact, it was a very, very difficult challenge. One of the things that helped make it a success was the fact that you had an administrator by the name of James Webb, who was in charge of NASA from 1961 right into 1969. And he was an outstanding public sector official. He was able to drive the organization to get the results that they were looking for. But it's not an easy process.
Bill, John has just referred to traps. And of course, in the book, you identify seven, what you call deadly traps that keep big things from getting done in government. Tell me what those seven traps are.
The first trap is what we call Tolstoy syndrome. And that's essentially known as confirmation bias, and that's when you only look at evidence that confirms your worldview, and you let ideology get in the way of what works.
The second trap is the overconfidence trap, and that is when a lot of public officials are overconfident when they're trying to launch and implement a big project. They underestimate how difficult it's going to be.
And we found another trap that we call design-free design, and that's essentially when you have the root of many of these implementation failures actually lies with faulty design, in that we design legislation to get through Congress or to get through the city council, yet not to work in the real world. And so you end up with a design that's unworkable.
There's also the Stargate trap, which is when a piece of legislation is getting through Congress or another legislative body, a lot of issues can arise before that legislative design actually gets enacted into law. And we're sort of seeing that in the last stages of the healthcare debate today, as a lot of factors are coming into play at the last minute that can add complexity and failure points to a program.
And one other trap that we'll mention here is what we call the complacency trap. And that's essentially after a program's been in place or an agency's been in place for some time, and it's a failure to reevaluate and reexamine whether it still makes sense today, whether it makes sense doing it in that same way. And we become complacent about it, and what's already there, whether it's an agency or program, gets in the way of what could be. And we spend a lot of time in the book talking about how do you overcome that trap, whether it's urban school systems or different aspects of government.
And I think that throughout the process, what we found was that it is harder to get big things done in the public sector because of unique characteristics of government. There's the politics, there's the short-term window for political leaders, there are the incentive issues and issues around personnel and pay that make it even more challenging in the public sector to achieve big things than in the private sector. We all know that the private sector isn't perfect when it comes to attempting big things either.
You bring up a question I wanted to ask, and that is the traps you have identified, that some of which you've just described, are they, in your opinion, unique to government?
Absolutely not. Almost all of these traps you see occur in the private sector also. Design-free design, as we talk about, was a huge problem in manufacturing 20 years ago or so, where you would have for instance, chip manufacturers, the designers of the chips would do these very, very intricate designs, but they would then send them over to manufacturing and they couldn't actually produce them. And you ended up with a lot of problems in automobiles and other areas because of this gap between the designers and the implementers. And another trap I think that we see very often in the public sector, in the private sector, is this notion of overconfidence in their essentially ability to do these things, and they don't do all the risk mitigation measures that you need to, and then you end up with a failure once they're launching a product or a service. And so they're not unique, but what we do in the book is we say that the government terrain is unique in a way, and most of these traps, it's even more difficult to avoid them and get past them in the public sector, so it requires, you know, a great deal of skill. And, you know, we found that one of the key things in having a successful initiative was the presence of what we call a bridger, which is a public official who can bridge the political side and the bureaucratic side. It's that, you know, 25-year city employee whose managers, who people will who will go to when they need to really get something important done.
Let's dial back then and talk in more detail about some of these traps. I think, you know, the book is full of really interesting examples of each trap at work. And I want to start with your first trap, the Tolstoy trap. Share some of the examples that you use to illustrate that.
One example we use for the Tolstoy trap is with the idea of wage and price controls in the early 1970s, or the war on inflation. President Nixon had worked during World War II as in the Office of Price Controls in Washington, D.C., and he knew that wage and price controls didn't really work in a market economy. They were very difficult to enforce. And yet in the early 70s, in order to fight inflation, he actually instituted wage and price controls, and they did not work. That was followed up by President Ford, who actually thought that inflation was a psychological phenomenon. And he introduced the idea of the whip inflation now buttons, the WIN buttons, and in an address before Congress and the nation, urged everyone to don WIN buttons to fight inflation. The idea is actually laughable today, but at the time, he was basing his idea on the notion that it was a psychological or morale problem and sort of modeling it on the V for Victory program during World War II, where you could boost people's morale and confidence and change behaviors. In fact, inflation was not caused by bad morale. It was a monetary phenomenon, and that Ford's ideas and Nixon's ideas weren't successfully challenged before they got launched. If he had exposed those ideas to critical viewpoints, you probably never would have had programs as silly as the wage and price controls and the whip inflation now buttons.
Right. And, you know, we found that actually this trap, confirmation bias, the Tolstoy trap, is a really, really big problem today, where we have the red team and the blue team and conservatives and liberals listen to their own radio stations and TV stations, and they read their own blogs. And what we end up with is a society where everyone's views are being confirmed as opposed to being informed. Drew Weston, who studies how the brain works, he put together a lot of Republicans and Democrats, a number of them, and he had them watch the John Kerry-George Bush debate in 2004. And what he found was that he basically wired them up to MRI machines, and he found that their brains, when one of the candidates would essentially say something which was obviously problematic, and that it didn't register with their brains. Essentially, they were just rooting for their own guys. That the emotional part of the brain was working, but not the thinking part. And that's a big problem, I think, right now in our country. And one of the things we do in the book is try to say we need to have a diversity of opinions, and we need to find ways of breaking free of this trap.
Can you, given you describe the problem, but can you solve it?
Well, there absolutely are techniques that you can use to help overcome confirmation bias. One of the things you can do is to invite people who do have differing views to the table. And that includes not only differing political views, but also sort of differing professional approaches. For example, having an engineer or an anthropologist or an economist enter into a problem can sometimes provide new insights into how to approach it or solve it. And the acid rain dilemma in the 1980s, I don't know if you remember, during the 1980s, acid rain was a major environmental problem. The business world didn't want regulation, and the environmentalists wanted to stop coal-producing plants from producing. And it took an economist to come in and come up with a cap-and-trade technique that was able to break the logjam of thinking to get a piece of legislation that was signed into law and that has had a remarkably successful impact on the environment without having a huge detrimental impact on business. It's a major success of our times.
Yeah, we actually found, in fact, that a lot of the big successes that we've had in this country in the last 30 years, 40 years, were when ideological boundaries and other boundaries were crossed. Welfare reform, very successful, Democratic president and GOP Congress. As in acid rain reduction, a GOP senator, Democratic senator working with economists in London when they put a congestion charge in, which was the first big city in the world to do so. It was a socialist mayor adopting market reforms to achieve environmental ends. In Massachusetts, healthcare reform, the first state to have universal healthcare insurance, it was a Republican governor working with the Democratic legislature to expand healthcare coverage, but using market means. So there's a lot of examples of this, and what we call sometimes the policy mashups, essentially, where you're taking kind of two competing ideas and philosophies and putting them together, and it ends up with something even better than either side had originally.
Describing the effect of what you call the Stargate trap, you use what I think is a very powerful example of Judge Garrity's 1974 decision that the Boston public school system was unconstitutionally segregated and they had to do something about it. They had to remedy that. How then does the Stargate trap kick in?
Well, in that particular instance, what happened was that the judge decreed that the Boston schools had to be desegregated. But what he did was he issued his order on the last day of school in June and required that there be a desegregation plan in place the following September. So that only gave school officials 77 days over the course of a summer, with most officials on vacation and schools out of session, to prepare for this. And the plan that was used was hastily pulled off the shelf, as it were, and the results were absolutely disastrous for the city of Boston, for the students throughout the city. That was a case where it was really important to have much more planning, much more ability to implement, to take the time to develop an implementation approach that would actually work. And that happens sometimes when things get through the Stargate and they're not given enough time to be developed. The Medicare prescription drug launch in 2004 was similarly problematic because the legislation required the program be launched very quickly, and in a lot of ways, the government wasn't ready to do it.
This trap is obviously not inevitable. It's really a function of not having enough planning time. In other words, moving through the tough process along the journey of getting something approved, but then moving to implementation, just simply not having enough time, is the obvious way to avoid it, just to simply have more time between those two points on the journey?
Well, there's a little bit more to it than that. I mean, there's other kinds of distortions that can occur just before a piece of legislation is trying to get through that Stargate, trying to get those last votes that it needs. People put in a lot of requirements and extraneous factors and politically motivated amendments that can distort and make the design not work as well once it gets to the other side of the Stargate. And when it gets to the other side of the Stargate, it's in the bureaucracy and they have to implement the law as it was designed. And what happens is just before it gets passed, a lot of strange things happen to the blueprints that can cause a lot of problems once things are getting launched.
You know, I have a question about this because it's really been provoked, a thought has been provoked by the health insurance debate and how frustrating it is that, you know, it's the 1,000-page bill, but then many bills are 1,000 pages. I've wondered if it would help things if we put a page limit on bills. And I'm actually very serious about that. I'm curious about your management consulting reaction to that. If we had a limit that no bill would be longer than, I don't know, 30 pages, 40 pages, something that actually people could sit down, including senators and congressmen, could actually sit down and read themselves.
Yeah, I think that there is something to what you're saying, is that the complexity of some of these initiatives work against their likelihood of success, because you never know. When something is very complicated and has a lot of different parts to it, you never know exactly how it's going to play out in the real world. And Congress tends not to spend a lot of time probing legislation for potential weaknesses and really having the time to understand all the aspects of legislation.
I mean, can anyone really understand a 1,000-page bill?
We do think it's actually important to have detailed blueprints when you do these things. But the legislations that's worked the best, the systems have been ones where we had pilot projects, where we had it tried out at the city level, at the state level, where we had some history behind it, so we knew it was going to work. So let's take welfare reform. Welfare reform, basically, you'd seen some success in Wisconsin over the years, and some other localities had done it. So by the time it came to Congress in 1994, as the bill drafters told us, they were just riding a wave. We already knew pretty much what would work and what wouldn't work. And what they did in welfare reform then was they gave some general parameters and some general goals that, you know, both the Clinton White House and the GOP Congress and the governors could back. And then they let the states and localities decide how to meet those goals. And that's that tends to be a much better approach, an approach that tends to work fairly well, because, you know, another example is immigration reform. We've had a lot of difficulty with immigration reform, and we saw with the McCain-Kennedy bill a few years ago, it was very, very complex, and opponents were able to kill it, essentially, at the Stargate. But that's another example where the differences in Arizona versus New York versus Texas versus California are so vast in terms of these issues, that trying to do a one-size-fits-all national model where you're trying things that have never been tried before can be a recipe for disaster. So one of the things that we argue in the book is that we need to do a lot more testing and prototyping before we go to scale with some of these large initiatives.
And yet you couldn't, I would think that there's no way to test putting a man on the moon. You couldn't pilot it. You couldn't do it in one state. I'm wondering about those things that are just by their very nature, you know, it's a big idea and you either do it in whole or not.
All these initiatives are unique, and there's some unique aspects to each. But the idea of testing, if you cannot test it at a state level, it's really important then to try it or to expose it to a group of people whose job is to try to poke holes in the particular set of legislation. The Man on the Moon is a little bit unique because you weren't going to find out if your technology worked and if your systems were going to work until you were able to do it.
That makes sense. There's one more trap I want you to talk about quickly, and that's the silo trap. Because I think we all hear this word, oh, you operate in silos. Explain the silo trap.
Well, you know, the silo trap is actually, you can look at it at two different ways. The familiar way people think of the silo trap is simply the fact that you have a lot of government departments and agencies that are operating and they're not talking a lot to each other. And you see, whether it's across levels of government or others. And the classic example of that was the intelligence community pre-9/11, right? We have 16 intelligence agencies and we have the FBI and we have all these things. And what happened was that those individual agencies, that they weren't sharing a lot of information. They weren't talking to each other. They were operating in silos, essentially, which was a big reason for why we missed some of the signals from 9/11. Now, the other way to think about the silo trap that we also talk about in the book is the fact that in this journey to success, to get a big initiative done, you have all these stages, the idea stage, the design stage, Stargate, you have implementation and launch. And in the private sector, for the most part, if you come up with a really good idea and that gets funding, you have to take that through usually all the way through to implementation. Now, in government, different people own each of those different stages, and no one tends to own the full process. And so they end up operating just in their silos. And so an example is a legislator might believe that a victory is simply getting a bill passed, when you've still got a long way to go, right? Because the bill doesn't tell you anything in terms of overall success. And so that tends to be a very, very big problem in government. And what we need to do is find ways of having ownership of that process from the beginning to the end.
Your final chapter is titled Creating a Better Future. Given all the traps that you explored and documented with wonderful examples in your book, what's your best advice for overcoming these traps? I mean, is there a small checklist that as citizens we can think about, using ourselves to say, is our government, in fact, using this checklist to make better decisions and reach success?
Yeah, I think the number one thing is that it's very important that average citizens have a better understanding of how their government works and some of the challenges that government faces in these big undertakings, so that they understand better that it's not a person's fault every time something goes wrong in government, that there are systemic challenges. And part of what our book seeks to do is to describe those challenges, because once you're aware of them, you can try to take steps to avoid them, and also to provide concrete, specific suggestions for ways of thinking about things and ways of approaching challenges that can improve the likelihood of success on big public undertakings.
And so some specific checklists that I would say would be that you want to make sure that your government officials are taking the time to listen to opposing viewpoints and incorporating those into the design. You want to make sure that the initiative is designed to work in the real world, not just to pass the city council or Congress. You want to have thoughtful debate and not have something rammed through before that. You want to make sure that the design is tested in smaller pilots when possible before rolling out nationally or citywide. You want to take failure seriously and take precautions against everything that could go wrong. And lastly, you want to make sure that you constantly reevaluate an initiative, even if it's been very successful, to make sure it's still on track. Because otherwise, we're going to end up with kind of very archaic systems and programs that don't make sense anymore in this very rapidly changing world we're living in.
Yeah, our nation faces some incredible challenges right now. Two wars, a failing economy, unsustainable fiscal red ink at all levels of government. And yet the biggest challenge we face of all might be trying to fix the process by which we tackle big challenges. Because if we don't start focusing on that process and improving the way we tackle things, we won't be able to handle successfully any of those other challenges.
Thanks so much for being our guest on Smart City. William Eggers and John O'Leary are the authors of the book, If We Can Put a Man on the Moon. Finally this week, our City Views commentator Walker Smith takes a deeper look into how the American dream stacks up to reality.
We all believe in the American myth. Equality, opportunity, self-reliance, charity, responsibility, free enterprise. We know this myth well, and we salute it and celebrate it regularly. It drives us to work every morning, and it ships us abroad to risk life and limb in its defense. It is a vital force that animates our sense of national purpose and moral character. And yet, it is a myth. Our national myth isn't really factually true. But that's okay. Myths aren't meant to hold a mirror up to reality. Myths aren't secured by facts. They are not reports from the field. Instead, they are reports from the heart. They speak to the best in us, to what we could be. They tell of what's exceptional about us, not what's pedestrian about us. They define our hopes, our aspirations, our dreams. And that's what makes America special. We dream big. Sure, we fail and disappoint ourselves all the time. Our politics are bitter, divisive, uncivil, boorish, even violent on more occasions than we care to remember. Our forefathers articulated some of the highest ideals ever spoken by political thinkers, yet did so with their feet on the throats of Native Americans and African Americans. Women have long struggled, as have gays and lesbians. Our educational, welfare, and health care systems pale in comparison to those in many other countries. Greed is our tragic flaw. Pride and conceit color our temperament. We just don't live up to our ideals. Yet we do have an allegiance to a special set of ideals embodied in the American myth. Facts that contradict a myth are beside the point. I realize that this seems like I'm trying to justify not focusing on problems or failings, but that's not the case. I definitely think we must hold ourselves accountable and remedy our faults. I also think, though, that our faults don't tell the full story about us. The other part of the story is what we aspire to, what we believe in, what we hold ourselves accountable to. There are lots of places where the vision of life held by people does not inspire me. The facts of their actual situations are not terribly bad in these places, often no worse, and sometimes even better than the situations of Americans. But the hopes, dreams, values, and myths that characterize these places are oppressive or vulgar or fatalistic. Americans are not resigned to accept things as they are. Our entire history has been one of making things better. And this is one thing that I worry about in the mess we have made of politics and ideological discussions of late. We seem to have talked ourselves into warring camps, fighting for fixed ideas or a return to the good old days of the past, opposing ideas that fail to acknowledge a shared myth or a commitment to constantly working on making reality better live up to our ideals. There is much to be said for constancy, heritage, and continuity. But that sort of stolidity is not part of the American myth. The driving ideals of America are about making ourselves better. Change is an inherent part of what America has always stood for. We have never shackled ourselves to the past. We have always reached out to the future. The only thing permanent about America is our commitment to innovation, to making things better, to being willing to change, no matter how difficult, when change is what it takes to stay true to the American myth, that American dream. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is the president of the Yankelovich Monitor, a trend service of the Futures Company. He joins us each week from Georgia Public Broadcasting in Atlanta. There's more Smart City for you online. Go to smartcityradio.com to download past shows, sign up for our newsletter, and get links to our guest work. You can subscribe to our podcast and have Smart City delivered straight to you. You can also get in touch with us by clicking on the contact button or send email to questions@smartcityradio.com. Smart City's web content and audio archive are supported by CEOs for Cities. I'm Carol Coletta.